Today, there is a growing recognition that we require a psychology of balance and integration. Awareness of the world and awareness of the self are equal necessities for optimal human existence. Too much of an external focus commonly results in self-estrangement, spiritual impoverishment, and the compulsive pursuit of activity for its own sake. Too much of an internal focus leads to passivity, helplessness in the face of the basic problems of existence, and resignation to avoidable human suffering. This also results in self-alienation. The repression of emotion and the disowning of experience are the precursors of self-alienation. They inevitably sabotage clarity of thinking and the integrity of consciousness, with disastrous consequences for autonomy, especially in the area of value judgments. In order to function successfully, a person needs to be in contact with his or her world and with his or her own needs, feelings, desires, frustrations, capabilities, and goals. If awareness is blocked in either direction, life and well-being are impaired. We need to see out and we need to see in. It is important to understand that a blindness concerning important aspects of self leads to a blindness concerning important aspects of the environment. For example, a person who denies a need for companionship and nurturing may be oblivious to opportunities to satisfy that need, such as signs of interest and friendship from people who care. A person who denies the reality of his or her pain will be blind to the source of pain, such as the wrong kind of friends, and be hurt again and again by these friends. A person who disowns feelings of anger may falsely attribute them to others and see anger where it doesn't exist. This is the process of projection. We deal here, then, with a profoundly important law of psychological functioning. Awareness moves freely in both directions, or it moves freely in neither. But how do self-blindness, self-fragmentation, and self-alienation come into being? That is the issue we are now going to consider. Self-alienation or self-fragmentation may refer to one or more problems, including dissociation from the body as part of self, being out of touch with our needs, emotional blockage, being cut off from explicit awareness of thoughts, attitudes, inclinations, or yearnings, the denial of important capacities that lie dormant or unrecognized. Taken as a whole, this is a condition I describe as the disowned self. To disown means to cease to recognize as our own, to cease to recognize our body, our emotions, our thoughts, our attitudes, our aspirations, our abilities as ours. In this way, we radically restrict and impoverish our sense of self. We have less access to our inner goals, and consequently, we become more dependent on signals from others. We need others to tell us what to think, how to live, when to express which emotion, what is appropriate and what is inappropriate, and so forth. By ourselves, we barely exist. Our sense of self is often reduced to little more than a sense of anxiety. In such a state of self-alienation, we are prone to becoming approval addicts, or love addicts, or belief system addicts. Self-alienation prevents autonomy. Let's begin our discussion with alienation from the body. The infant's first sense of self is almost entirely as a body self. This was what Freud meant when he said that our first ego is a body ego. Later, as the mind develops, the child learns to relocate the sense of self upward. Ego and self find their primary location in the mind. When growth proceeds appropriately, the body is recognized as part of self, but not the totality. Consciousness differentiates from the body, or as some would say, transcends body, and a more complex and comprehensive sense of self evolves. But inherent in this process is the potential for dissociation from body. Where there is dissociation, body is neither all of self or even an aspect of self, but rather non-self. In our culture, the overwhelming majority of people exist in varying degrees of estrangement from their own bodies. Often the voice of parents joins the voice of nuns, joins the voice of athletic coaches in encouraging that split. For example, the child can see the body as a source of parental irritation and even revulsion if the mother conveys disgust in the way that she bathes or touches it. Perhaps the child becomes ill and then begins to hate the body as a source of suffering and betrayal. Or the child sees a loved one sicken and die, and again the body is perceived as the traitor. It is the body that allows not only pain, but death to enter. In childhood or adolescence, the body may be perceived as the sinful source of sexual longings, and therefore of guilt. In school, a child's mind-body split may be encouraged through gym teachers, who see the body as an object to be beaten into performing, to be controlled and manipulated. Autonomy begins with the body. The first voice of the authentic self is the voice of the body. The body isn't all there is to autonomy by any means, but it is the foundation. People are often ignorant of their own bodies, dangerously out of touch with them. This attitude is encouraged in all spheres. In the medical realm, numerous reports have shown that a chief cause of damage to patients, including death, is the doctor's failure to listen to the patient. This arises from the conviction that the body is a foreign object that the patient knows nothing about. The solution lies in the ability to hold two thoughts in our heads at the same time. On the one hand, I am more than my body. On the other, my body is me, a part of me, a manifestation and expression of me. Therefore, getting to know myself includes getting to know my body. If I allow my body to remain a stranger, then, in an important way, I remain a stranger to myself. No matter how much we value autonomy intellectually, the degree to which we can achieve it is intimately related to the degree of integration among our mind, emotions, and body. Autonomy is more than cerebral. It involves our entire being. Let's now consider the problem of alienation from our needs, feelings, and emotions. We live in the psychological age, or at the beginning of one. There has never been so much awareness on the part of so many people that often they do not know what they feel, what they long for, or where they are going. There are several sources of this emotional self-alienation or unconsciousness. The simplest and most obvious is that most parents teach children to repress their feelings and emotions. They teach unconsciousness as a positive value, as one of the costs of being loved, found acceptable, and regarded as grown up. Furthermore, emotionally remote and inhibited parents tend to produce emotionally remote and inhibited children. The parents' behavior signals to the child what is proper, appropriate, and socially acceptable. Now, what precisely is an emotion? An emotion is both a mental and physical event. It is an automatic psychological response involving our mind and body as we subconsciously appraise some aspect of reality. Emotions reflect a person's value response to different aspects of reality, for me or against me, good for me or harmful, to be pursued or to be avoided, and so forth. To stop knowing what we feel is to stop experiencing what things mean to us. This is to be cut off from our own context. As children, most of us were taught to see this state as normal. Let me emphasize that I am talking about feelings and emotions, not about actions. I am not suggesting that we should act on or express everything we feel, not even in our most intimate relationships. We can't avoid the responsibility of discrimination and judgment. But here we are concerned with the issue of consciousness itself. What are we allowed to be conscious of? What are we forbidden to be conscious of? A child is typically encouraged by parents to conclude that emotions are potentially dangerous, that sometimes it is advisable to deny them, to pretend they're not there, incur us to believe that emotions must be, quote, controlled, unquote. The child learns to disown the emotions and learns to cease experiencing them. This is a process of self-numbing. Just as emotions are a mental and a physical state, the assault on emotions occurs on two levels. On the psychological level, a child deflects awareness and ceases to recognize or acknowledge undesired feelings. On the physical level, a child inhibits breathing, tenses his or her body, induces muscular tensions, and blocks the free flow of feelings. Teachers also communicate many messages concerning which feelings and emotions are acceptable and which are not. Again, the child's fears contribute to the process of self-estrangement, since children pass on the messages they receive from their elders. It is a child of rare independence who manages to withstand this onslaught and to remain in good, healthy contact with his own inner state, with his own inner feelings. In the process of individuation, a person encounters obstacles from the very beginning of life. The child is taught that certain feelings or emotions are unacceptable. Nonetheless, they are felt. So, the child has a problem, and the child generates a solution, and the solution is called unconsciousness. While self-alienation is clearly encouraged by others, albeit often unwittingly, this is by no means the only source of the problem. A child can use repression and denial and disowning to defend against any feeling the child experiences as threatening or overwhelming, be it pain, anger, fear, sexuality, excitement, and so forth. For the majority of children, the early years of life contain many painful and frightening experiences. Perhaps a child has parents who never respond warmly to physical needs, or who continually scream at the child or at each other, or who use fear and guilt as a means of exercising control, or who swing between over-solicitude and callous remoteness, who subject the child to lies and mockery, who are neglectful and indifferent, who continually criticize and rebuke, or who subject the child to physical violence. A child isn't able to understand his or her own needs or the behavior of the parents. At times, fear and pain may be experienced as incapacitating. Rage seems terrifying to reveal or express. And so, in order to function, the child decides, wordlessly and helplessly, that the inner world of feelings must be escaped, that contact with emotions is sometimes intolerable. The fear, pain, and anger are not permitted to be experienced, expressed, and discharged. They are frozen into the body, barricaded behind walls of muscular and physiological tension. The child develops a pattern of reaction that will tend to recur whenever threatening feelings are about to emerge. And just as fear, pain, and anger tend to be blocked, so, alas, do sexuality, excitement, and joy. Any powerful response that threatens to disrupt equilibrium, bring down parental disapproval, evoke guilt, or endanger self-esteem, any such powerful response can be blocked, inhibited, held back. To varying degrees, then, the child learns to play dead in order to survive. In order to protect self-esteem, the child learns to surrender more and more of the self. The average child becomes an expert at self-sacrifice at the most profound psychological level, the level of mind and spirit, the level of the life force itself. This problem, which originates in childhood, becomes built into a person's manner of being and coping with life. By adulthood, the condition of self-alienation feels all too natural. Emotions tend to become muted, diluted, and trivialized. Emotional life tends to be distorted. Surface feelings defend against and conceal deep feeling, misleading both self and others. And in this way, deep pain may be concealed beneath surface anger. Anger may be concealed behind a surface indifference that becomes, quote, unconscious, unquote, cruelty. A deep longing for love and companionship may be buried beneath a facade of cheerful, happy-go-lucky self-sufficiency. I remember my acutely painful teenage feelings of loneliness and of longing for someone with whom I could share my thoughts, interests, and feelings. But by then I had accepted the view that loneliness was a weakness, and longing for human intimacy represented a failure of independence. I clung to self-alienation as a virtue. I convinced myself I didn't care. I told myself I had my thoughts and my books, and that that was enough, or that it should be, if I were properly self-reliant. I didn't begin to understand until my 20s that if I had accepted my desire for human contact from the beginning, my emotional development and subsequent relationships would have been more natural and certainly more satisfying. Sometimes, in order to awaken a person to a problem of emotional self-alienation, I will simply ask him or her to become absolutely still, breathe into the abdomen, and be available to any feelings or emotions that may spontaneously begin to arise. Within a few minutes, a person may report feelings of sadness or anxiety or anger that seem to have sprung up out of nowhere. Not uncommonly, a person will begin to cry. Opening the breathing is generally the first step to opening the feelings. It creates a condition of stillness. When we stop running, our emotions have a chance to catch up with us, to enter conscious experience. This is why meditation can be a powerful tool for the releasing of blocked feelings and emotions. Its emphasis on breathing and on stillness can lead a novice at meditation to violent and even frightening emotional eruptions. Serenity may not occur until later stages of meditative practice. You can't fully understand the problem of emotional repression if you don't appreciate that the average person carries within his or her being the burden of an enormous quantity of unacknowledged and undischarged pain. Not only pain originating in the present, but pain stemming from the early years of life. Many years ago, I was discussing this phenomenon with some colleagues. One psychiatrist felt I was exaggerating the magnitude of the problem in the general population. Since I sensed a debate would be futile, I asked him if he would participate in a demonstration. He said he would be glad to, but warned me that he had had an exceptionally happy childhood. He said his parents had always been marvelously sensitive and responsive to his needs. It might be better to ask for another volunteer, he said, as he had no desire to embarrass me. I said that I would like to work with him. He laughed and invited me to proceed. I asked him to do an exercise that I sometimes use with my clients in therapy. He sat back in his chair, relaxed his body, let his arms rest at his sides, and closed his eyes. Now, I said, I want you to accept the following situation. You are lying on a bed in a hospital, and you are dying. You are at your present age. You are not in physical pain, but you are aware of the fact that in a few hours your life will end. Now in your imagination, look up and see your mother standing at the side of the bed. Look at her face. There is so much unsaid between you. Feel the presence of all the unsaid between you. All the things you've never told her, all the thoughts and feelings you have never expressed. If ever you would be able to reach your mother, it is now. If ever she would hear you, it is now. Talk to her. Tell her what it was like to be her son. As I talked, his hands clenched into fists, blood rushed to his face, and one could see around his eyes and forehead the muscular tension that was aimed at suppressing tears. When he spoke, it was in a younger and much more intense voice. one that rose in a moan as he said, "When I spoke to you, why didn't you ever listen to me? Why didn't you ever listen?" It was obvious that this man had been speaking sincerely when he had referred to his childhood as a happy one. But in repressing his early pain, he was disowning important feelings, therefore disowning a part of himself. The consequence for him as an adult was not only an emotional impairment, but also a thinking impairment. His distorted judgments would affect his present effectiveness in human relationships. The numbness that he evoked to make his childhood bearable left him still today with major numb, dead areas in his personality. I might mention, if you want to try this little exercise yourself, that it's productive to do it in fantasy with both parents, separately, of course, one parent at a time, and you can also adapt it to an encounter with any important person in your life, such as a spouse. You could imagine dying and talking to your spouse. Or you can do the whole exercise in reverse, imagining that somebody other than you but close to you is dying, and you're the person visiting in the hospital. And how does that feel? And what do you want to say? When the exercise is done as I have described, the emotion tapped into more often than any other is disowned pain, often combined with anger. Reconnecting with and experiencing disowned pain enables us to gain a new perspective on old experiences. It allows us to integrate that which is underground and sealed off from conscious awareness. The past then begins to lose its hold over the present. Otherwise, we remain prisoners of the things we don't confront. At any age, whenever there is loss, there is a psychological need for mourning, a period during which we allow ourselves to feel our pain, reflect on what has gone from our life and how we are affected by that absence. This is an essential step in the healing process. We need to mourn a death, a divorce, the breakup of a love affair, the loss of a friend, the failure of a career aspiration, the defeat of a dream. To face our painful emotions is to allow them to be felt, to acknowledge them, to listen to the messages they contain, and perhaps to describe in words to ourselves or to someone else just what we are feeling. It requires courage and honesty. This is not an exercise in self-pity. To say, "Right now I am feeling forlorn, miserable, and hopeless," is not self-pity. To say, "My situation is hopeless," is usually self-pity. In the first instance, we are describing a feeling. In the second, we are making a statement of alleged fact. This is a very important distinction. Descriptions of feelings, however painful, can be therapeutic. Statements of alleged facts about the cruelty of life are often self-destructive. In the first case, we're seeking to enhance awareness. In the second, we make no effort to deal with our suffering or understand it. Unfortunately, few of us were educated in this distinction, and few of us appreciate its importance to our lives, not only with regard to the mourning process, but with regard to any painful experience we may need to confront. We cannot free ourselves from something we've never experienced. We cannot leave a place we have never been. Fritz Perls coined the expression "unfinished business" to describe unresolved life experiences that distort and subvert our responses in the present. Unfinished business represents a blockage of the maturing process. Repression of feeling is often the cause of such a blockage. That is why opening the feelings is a central goal in so many of the newer psychotherapies. Much of psychotherapy helps the client deal with the consequences of unmet needs in an earlier stage of his or her life. No single task in this effort is more important than liberating the client's ability to feel. For example, a child rarely feels free to express feelings of anger and rage. More often, there is the thought that says, "If mother or father knew what I was feeling, I would be killed or abandoned."
Too often, it is perceived that anger is too dangerous to express. And years later, the adult is still operating on the basis of that childhood perception. Sometimes the anxiety of a child's early years is too much to bear. It feels utterly incapacitating. So, it is repressed. But to be repressed is not to go out of existence. What is denied by the mind is trapped inside the body. Let a therapist work the appropriate muscles on the neck or face or throat or chest or diaphragm or thighs, wherever the block may appear to be located, and the long-denied feelings will erupt. The fear will be experienced, expressed, and discharged. If this process is consummated successfully, the adult will understand and feel organismically why he or she has retreated from so many of the challenges of life. He or she will understand why the avoidance of frightening situations has taken priority over almost all other considerations, why life has been so circumscribed and restricted. And then a new and wider vision of life's options becomes available. As feelings are experienced, the mind clears. Autonomy becomes a more realistic possibility. Thoughts, feelings, and actions are sometimes used improperly when we wish to avoid confrontation with some frightening or painful aspect of reality. In the area of thought, there is the intellectual who discusses his or her personal problems as though they belong to someone else. This person does not experience the emotional meaning of anything he or she says or hears. Such a person prefers to talk about psychology in general rather than his or her own agony in particular. This individual may be engaged in mental activity to avoid awareness rather than to expand it. In the area of feeling, there is the person who may dwell on the emotion of sadness but refuses to confront the rage beneath it, or who blindly surrenders to anger while refusing to confront the pain that motivates it, or who talks endlessly about emotions as a means of avoiding knowing what he or she most deeply feels. In the area of action, there is the man or woman who is impatient with thought and scornful of emotions. This person runs compulsively from one activity to another, dreading to face the question of what these actions are adding up to. This person uses action to avoid facing the meaning and significance of action. I'd like to stress again that flight from inner experience is by no means confined to negative feelings and emotions. Often we repress and disown our excitement, our enthusiasm, and our happiness. We may have been ridiculed for such feelings in the past. Perhaps no one seemed to understand or share them. Or maybe experiencing them increases our painful sense of aloneness. Avoidance always has its reasons, to be sure. The individual is trying to protect himself, to ensure his well-being, to preserve self-esteem, but is doing so in the wrong way, a way that doesn't work, a way that produces self-defeat. When we bury feelings and emotions, we also bury ourselves. This is what it means to exist in a state of alienation. We rarely appreciate it, but the truth is, the sad truth is, we are lonely for ourselves. If we can experience our feelings, then we can choose to either express them or contain them. Sometimes one option is desirable, sometimes the other. But if we are blocked, we don't have that choice. Obviously, it's unhealthy to be entirely unable to contain our emotions. But to tell ourselves that we don't want to let anyone know what we feel, when the truth is that we are blocked, is to practice self-deception. We also evolve through interaction at the level of feeling and emotion. If we don't allow ourselves to have the normal emotions of a child, we impede our growth to adolescence. If we don't allow ourselves to have the normal emotions of an adolescent, we don't evolve into well-integrated adults. Sometimes, when we are older, we fling ourselves into the feelings, emotions, and behavior appropriate to an earlier stage of development. This is done, typically, in an unconscious effort at self-healing, to give ourselves the childhood or adolescence we never had. Our behavior may bewilder and appall our family and friends. We ourselves are unlikely to understand it. A man of 45 may find himself carrying on like a teenager. He may feel awkward and embarrassed, yet unable to stop. In all likelihood, unless he becomes conscious of his actions and their intentions, he'll begin to repress himself again. Then nothing ever gets solved. The pain is never relieved. The joy is never expressed. And he helplessly settles into what he has been taught to call the realism and practicality of middle age. What should a person do in this situation? It's far better to permit the mind free play in fantasy than to engage in self-condemnation and self-censorship. It's preferable to search for realistic, non-destructive ways to satisfy pent-up longings than to escape in repression and unconsciousness. Sometimes we may have longings and fantasies that we have no way of fulfilling. It may simply be too late, or fulfilling them may clash with other important values. Sometimes we need to make hard choices. But often people dismiss their longings, telling themselves that fulfillment is impossible, and in fact, perhaps nothing stands in the way except the rigidity of their own thinking or their fear of family or social disapproval. If we don't learn to listen to ourselves, to respect our inner signals, if we are too quick to assume self-denial and self-sacrifice as a necessity, we miss opportunities for growth and enrichment. Feelings are often the first sign that something is wrong with our life. We need thought in order to know what to do, but feelings often alert us to the existence of a problem. If we ignore or repress feelings that challenge our ordinary routine, then we condemn ourselves to living mechanically, at a level of consciousness or unconsciousness that forbids authenticity and autonomy. In our personal life, if we can't feel deeply, it's very difficult to think clearly. This is contrary to the notion that thinking and feeling are opposing functions and that each entails the denial of the other. We can avoid perceptions and thoughts just as we can avoid feelings and emotions. A child, for example, may observe behaviors in parents that are terrifying. Mother is a liar, father is a brute, and so forth. The child can twist consciousness to deny this, to forget it, to wipe out an awareness that seems to make daily existence intolerable. We may have been raised in a particular religion, philosophy, or belief system that we have accepted for many years. Then one day, something within us begins to challenge it. We find ourselves wondering if any of it is really true. Or we begin to find no sense in it. But we're afraid that our thinking may alienate us from the people we have been close to for so many years. So we alienate ourselves from ourselves instead by cutting off, denying what we had begun to become aware of. Sometimes the thoughts and feelings we repress are those beckoning us toward a higher level of development. We may disown our depths of terror or rage, or we may disown our glimpses of the heights of peace or ecstasy waiting for us at the next level of growth. As we disown the child within, so we can disown the sage within, meaning the wisest part of us, the most daring, the most intelligent, the most intuitive about our ultimate needs. Certainly, the positive force we are often most prone to disown is our intelligence. We fear the turbulence of too much awareness. We cling the most to the attachment that binds us to the present level of our development, the one that says, stop, go no further. I often think about the millions of times new ideas die stillborn. New possibilities are left unexplored. Creative and spiritual yearnings are ignored or repressed. Either we are afraid of the unknown, or we are accustomed to tuning out unfamiliar inner signals. Creativity, psychological, and spiritual growth both require times of aloneness, silence, meditation, and contemplation so that inner signals can be heard and can become conscious. The essence of the disowning process is that the self is at war with the self. The correction of this process is the central subject of the next cassette.